Thank you, David. So we have plenty of time for questions and discussion. I think we have a roving wireless mic here. While people are germinating their own questions, I have one I wanted to pose to you, which might be unfair on at least two levels. It's very U.S.-specific and it's very legalistic, so I'm going to play to all of your strengths and mine as well. I'm not a lawyer either. But I thought you framed so beautifully for us this issue of presumption of guilt, the sort of cumulative disadvantage, but also the erasure of a presumption of innocence. People are capturing it in the sense of a pre-crime. So I wonder, do you have a sense of a kind of more, perhaps more effective political and even legalistic response being not to go after either the first or fourth U.S. amendments, Bill of Rights, but the fifth against self-incrimination? And again, I have maybe a poor historical analogy in mind about the early Cold War, sort of height of McCarthyism. The Fifth Amendment was also often trampled in the courts for a few years. But that one was, if I recall, one of the first to be turned around and actually mounted successfully in the era of Red Scare. We can talk about the timeline and all that. But I wonder if it's the self-incrimination angle that might be even more potent. So if we shouldn't all be suspects. It's not just you should know what I'm purchasing on Amazon. So I wonder if you have thoughts on that, or if it speaks to similar issues in Canada or other areas.
Yeah. So great question, and completely unfair, as you say.
Yeah.
I think there are so many kind of basic starting points that could helpfully be explored for thinking about precisely these issues. And I do think that looking again at first, fourth, and fifth amendments would be tremendously helpful for getting to grips with what is really going on here. I mean, as you can hear, mine is kind of a plea for, yes, let's hear what Snowden's saying, but let's get beyond the kind of tabloid approach, the binary. So let's think about the bigger issues that are raised by this, because it seems to me that they are singularly important. And here, one of the most common and innocent-sounding and at the same time profoundly pernicious phrases that we are encouraged to believe is, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. And that seems to me to be a key issue in that is part of your question, David. If you think about it, that is a wonderful thing to believe. It would be great to think that if we have nothing to hide, then we truly have nothing to fear. You can see how attractive it is. And who would not like to live in a world where, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear? As you mull it, you can think, yes, that is a great place to be. And then you realize why it is such an attractive lie. It cannot be true in these circumstances, and many others either, but in these circumstances especially, if what I'm saying has any veracity whatsoever to it, if I'm correct in any way in saying that surveillance has to do, if not primarily, certainly it has to do an awful lot procedurally and in terms of method, classifying populations into groups according to certain criteria, ask the question for yourself, decided by whom? Where did those criteria come from? Did you participate in deciding how those categories would be worked out? Just a few small questions for you to ask. But if that is how surveillance is primarily being operated, and if that is facilitated by the use of advanced algorithms, parallel computing, and so on and so forth, if that is the case, then what it means is that in every kind of surveillance that is going on, the key thing is not whether you personally have something to hide or not. It makes not a blind bit of difference, because you are in a category that is already assumed to have certain kinds of characteristics, including assumptions about guilt in some cases. And you know, if you think of the Facebook example, then basically you can see that Facebook is where your friends betray you. Because the way your friends have been grouped by you, by them, is precisely the means whereby we can locate certain groups as suitable for certain kinds of advertising purposes, but equally as those data are used by the NSA and other government-related agencies for other kinds of purposes. So it doesn't actually answer your question. That can be left to you and your friends. But I think that that phrase that I hadn't mentioned before is really one that we need to interrogate and argue about in the public domain and make it very clear that there are far bigger questions to be asked about that very phrase.
Hi, my name is Alex Matthews. I'm the National Chair for Store the Fourth here in the United States. There are a couple of thoughts that occur to me among the many. One is that there is an issue here with the use of our personal data that relates to the stability of the legal subject over time. That we sign up for a product or a service or an online community and disclose information about ourselves in an ongoing pattern, and that we may start to do so at an age where we have not reflected on the consequences of disclosing that information, and then that information can be used against us later as mature legal subjects. There is a requirement implicit in surveillance of a stable legal self intertemporally without attendant mechanisms of forgetting of information or of mercy for that information and an assumption of consent that is continuous with your first participation in digital media, which I think will be an increasing problem. The second element of this is that I think there has been so much attention paid to the interface between corporate power and state power when it comes to surveillance, because there is a notion that if the barriers between the two were high, then commercial surveillance would, in a sense, be much more harmless than it is today. And one of the elements that Snowden has disclosed is how low those barriers have become and how automatic it has become for information voluntarily disclosed to a corporate entity to make its way into the bowels of the surveillance state. So I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on those two topics, if you have them.
Yeah, great. So clearly we're on the same page to a certain extent, so thank you for that. Couple of things. I mentioned the little report that we've made by our team on transparent live surveillance in Canada. And we deliberately chose to make the first chapter, which is about the expansion of surveillance generally, to be a fictional account of a 9-year-old girl. And with this kind of thing in mind, that to remind us that there are generational issues here and there's also continuity between generations with regard to legal identities that you referred to. So Farah is the name of the girl that is the subject of our first chapter, which is a story. And let me commend it to you. I think you'll enjoy the story about Farah, but it, as I say, it has a pedagogic purpose in helping us think about these broader matters of the continuity, the stability of the legal self, and it's a great comment. The other is this. When people say, well, what can we do? What sort of thing do you suggest? I think we have to acknowledge that there are numerous levels on which some kind of work has to be undertaken. One clearly is the legal, the statutory. There has to be a call for accountability. Privacy frequently, in use both in the United States and Canada and elsewhere, puts the onus on the individual. I've had my privacy invaded, or I've been violated. I have to find out what's happened. I have to take steps, legal steps, technical steps, setting up encryption, whatever. It pushes the onus onto the individual, which is bizarre when you think that it's massive global corporations and massive government organizations that are doing the surveillance. What chance do little individuals like us stand? So the argument has to be made for proper accountability, it seems to me, and of course that's where part of the debate has been, for the organizations that hold and process, gather in the first place, hold and process personal data. So that's one area. It's crucial that we look at the legal dimension, that we plead for changes in the law. But another level is the level of, if you like, cultural change. And that's where, again, questions of generation come in very importantly. It seems to me that one of the crucial areas is for, if you like, media education or internet education from the youngest level. I mean, those of you who have children or grandchildren who are growing up digital, as it were, you're aware that those devices can be used by some pretty young kids. And moreover, they know, frequently better than the adults, how to get into certain sites. And they know how to operate systems far better than I would. The question of cultural change more broadly, and therefore all the sorts of questions that I was trying to address this afternoon, are really important ones. And I don't think we should decry them or say, things are moving too fast or whatever. We are in an era where there are massive changes that are taking place that are imbricated with the digital. And it seems to me that to talk about cultural change is not airy-fairy. It's tremendously important. And then, of course, there are approaches that are individualized. Yes, I will set my encryption differently. I will do I will make some technical changes to what I do, or simply, guard myself. Throw my PTD away and never use it again, or whatever. Those kinds of responses, I think, are extremely limited, because the number of people who actually have such technical competence to be able to protect themselves is very limited. So it seems to me that the first effort should be made around legal change and, for start, obliging there to be a public kind of debate. And then the bigger questions of cultural change, those who have the capacity to, as it were, care for their own digital presence, sure, they can be encouraged to develop ways, and preferably shareable ways, and preferably cheap shareable ways of actually enabling that for other people as well. But it does seem to me that the bigger cultural question, if you like, and the legal, statutory, regulatory questions are ones that are the most urgent ones to discuss. Sorry, a bit of a long answer. There was a question over here.
Hi, thanks for your talk. My name is Jessa. I'm a researcher and also an information activist. And when you were listing the three F's of why we put up with surveillance, I was thinking of a fourth one, which would be fatigue. Right? Yep. The idea that among my admittedly skewed activist group, people are fatigued, and they're also beaten down by many of the things that you were just describing. Like, they just feel like there is no outside of Facebook. Facebook has shadow profiles. They don't have the luxury of getting rid of their phones. So the sense that even if they wanted to resist, they couldn't. And I suspect that partly comes from familiarity, these devices being so present, yeah. And partly from fun, the gamification of removing one's own privacy.
Yeah.
So I'm appreciative of many of the answers that you just gave, so you addressed part of what was my question, but maybe the other part would be, and you can pick, are there sort of, on a national level, efforts that you see being successful that would maybe give us examples of, for activists or people working in the United States or in Canada, sort of like maybe the mesh network movement, or are there examples that you see as successful? Virginia Eubanks has some really great pieces on like the most marginalized groups having long-term familiarity with surveillance. Are there groups who have been dealing with this for a much longer time that we've historically marginalized? Maybe we can turn to for ideas on what we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Great questions. Just remind me of the first one again.
Oh, international.
Yeah. Okay. So the examples in Canada, we have a group called OpenMedia.ca, and Open Media is basically what it sounds like. It's an internet group, and our Open Media group has managed to mobilize opinion against government attempts to legalize forms of surveillance that are extremely, not just intrusive, but extremely involved in all the things that I was saying, but especially the social sorting. And above all, attempting to increase the capacity of police in particular to obtain internet and telephone data without warrants. That's the crucial thing, a lawful access kind of area. And last year, in response to a bill that was before Parliament, OpenMedia.ca managed to mobilize opinion such that the largest ever online opinion, online petition in Canada, was, I think, I mean, people will debate this forever, was, I think, one of the key reasons why the government pulled the plug on that that attempt. And because it was online, and because they developed several neat little highly accessible videos that put the point just in an in-your-face way, so, you know, there was a, in one of the videos, there was an RCMP officer in a park approaching a young woman who was on her phone, and he leans in and walks alongside her, listening to her call. I mean, like I say, it's very crude, but it, as I say, attracted the largest petition in Canadian history of that kind, an online petition. And there is a current move that that bill was removed, but it has been replaced by another one that looks suspiciously like the first one. And it's under a quite different name, and the prolegomenon to it is quite different from the first one, but the body of it, like 75% of it, is a repeat of the old one. So, campaign is starting all over again, and the newest video came out last week. And so I think that those, you know, this is the ambiguity, if you like, of the internet. I think there are some very real possibilities for democratic involvement and for mobilization that relate precisely to these kinds of issues. So there's one example on the business of other kinds of organizations. I wish there were more in terms of sharing what we know. I was talking to somebody earlier on about the relative lack of surveillance studies groups in the U.S. You have some of the greatest surveillance studies scholars, but they tend to be operating on their own and not within a kind of team context. Frankly, we found it tremendously beneficial to work as a team. As I say, what I know because my team is good. What I talk about is not the result of my own little research, it's the result of the fact that I work with a team. And there's a lot of strength in working together as academics, and it's also true that in Canada, and I don't know quite how the NSF and other funding organizations in the US permit or encourage this, but within the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, we as an academic team can have partners who are not only non-academic, but who may be advocacy groups, civil liberties groups. We work with the Privacy Commissioner. So our partners are actually the International Civil Liberties Group, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, the Privacy Commission of the Federal Privacy Commission of Canada, the Privacy Commission of British Columbia. So we have a number of partners who don't just use our research. They're also engaged in the process of producing the research in the first place, in the sense that they help us and work with us in framing the issues. So that is something that is, I think, very beneficial. And then when it comes to the kinds of areas that you were talking about, Virginia Eubank's work on cumulative disadvantage, I mean, yeah, she's a prime example. There are people working, as it were, on their own and to produce great work. And it could be linked with the work of other people in the United States, in other countries as well. So I think there's a lot to be sought in terms of national and international networking. And as I say, I can give my own testimony about the value of team work. And it's certainly been very encouraging in our in the kinds of work that we've done. So thanks for the question.
Hi, I've got a quick comment and a question. The comment is, you're at MIT right now speaking, and MIT has a unique power to sort of shape the future of technology. So I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss the things that individuals might be able to do. Instead, you should be encouraging, you know, the technologists around, and everybody in the room should be encouraging the technologists to be shaping the future technologies so that things like, you know, encryption and other privacy protections, you know, are as trivial as surveillance seems to have become. But my question is, I think, almost philosophical. A few weeks ago, our local transportation authority was in the news because it's rolling out a spiffy new bus surveillance system. 6 cameras on each buses with live streaming to the control room, and they were showing off how, you know, a police cruiser can come up behind a bus and, you know, open up a laptop and see what was going on the bus, so they knew what they were encountering. And if you start doing the math about this, about how many live streams, how many screens, and you start looking at how much our DHS has given away in money to the transportation authority to put in cameras everywhere, and you start, you quickly realize there aren't people watching these things, and you quickly realize that the software, you know, to monitor these things is, you know, non-existent. So what we seem to have, you know, be paying for as taxpayers is this huge video screen that nobody's watching. I'm not quite sure what to do with that. I haven't wrapped my mind around it. It's surveillance, but it's also something else. I wonder if you could help me with this little personal philosophical dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so 2 questions about the cameras and also about being at MIT. Those cameras. Let me just commend a novel to you. Who has read Dave Eggers' The Circle? Okay, it's worth taking a look at. The novel by Dave Eggers came out last year, and it speaks of a Silicon Valley company that has taken over Yahoo, Google, whatever. And it is the company in Silicon Valley. And it's about May, a 24-year-old new employee at The Circle. And it's just a story about what May experienced when she was at The Circle. Their goal is total transparency. As I came in through the entrance of this building, which is very beautiful, I've never been in this building before. As I came in through the entrance, I realized that some of the architecture is very similar to that of The Circle, because you can see right into people's offices through the glass. And so The Circle is also a glass-dominated campus where you can see, but more importantly, you can see from the cameras everywhere what is going on at any given moment. And it's a fascinating novel, and I commend it to you because it speaks to surveillance in the 21st century. It speaks to big data surveillance. It speaks to surveillance of social sorting, etc., etc. But it's all in novel form, and maybe the novel is what we need to go back to in this discussion. Certainly it connects with the idea of cultural change that I was commending to you earlier on. So yeah, those cameras. It is curious that there is, in the case of camera surveillance, as in several others, no clear, direct relationship between the proven efficacy of the surveillance that is claimed for cameras and the rate of adoption of new cameras. That is to say, the rate of adoption of new camera systems far exceeds any statistics that would make you think that it was worth installing them in the first place. So that way back in 2008, for example, the police officer in charge of the Ring of Steel cameras in London, England, around the Central Financial District, acknowledged that the success rate of apprehending people involved in illegal activity within the Ring of Steel was, over a number of years, way less than 3%. And that was in the most surveilled area, domain, territory in the world. Less than 3% success rate over several years. And this was the person in charge of the program. He's supposed to be speaking for the program. So, gives you some clue. But if you look at the studies of camera surveillance, it is astonishing how fast the things are adopted and how little the actual result is. But, you know, they become cheaper and cheaper, so they're attractive. It looks like you're doing something, so there's a bit of theater there. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for installing cameras. There are caveats to make, however. You were saying, you know, there are thousands of feeds with no one watching. Well, if you talk to the people in video analytics, then you'll discover that what they're arguing for is automated forms of using all those feeds and all kinds of means of gauging what those bodies in space are up to, using algorithms to determine what sorts of activities are being engaged in, and so on and so forth. So don't let's imagine that those cameras are somehow going to go away, just even if it's shown that they aren't efficacious for the purpose that they were originally installed. Video analytics is a huge and very fast-growing area. And of course, as with all other kinds of surveillance, may well have some very positive and socially beneficial aspects to it as well. So that's, you know, I'm not dismissing it. Back to MIT, and here am I speaking against technical solutions. Yeah, I didn't mean it in quite the way that you were hinting. What I was saying, what I was against, was individualized solutions where the onus is put on the individual to protect herself with some encryption device or whatever. It seems to me that the so-called privacy by design movement is a very important one. Grows out of an earlier movement from the 1980s, social responsibility of computing. I mean, there's a long history to those kinds of attempts to build into software systems very different kinds of sensitivities than those that tend to be built in with the kind of commercial and governmental logics that we see. So it wasn't an argument at all against privacy by design, for example, as a movement. And it seems to me to be a tremendously important area for us to be working. No, I was referring merely to the kind of nerdy way of talking about privacy that says, well, I know what tools I can use and I can put something in here that'll protect me and I'll be okay. It just seems to me to be quite beside the point in the world that Snowden has revealed for us. Other questions, comments?
I'd like to ask a question. My name is John Thompson, and I want to take advantage of your kind offer to suggest that we think widely about the subject. Is there a way into thinking about some major considerations in our society? I'm a man of government. I've used intelligence. It seems to me that when you're in government, and I'm talking primarily about Western governments, there are two broad ways you can look at it. One way is to say, can it be done? And if the answer is yes, then we do it. And I think, for example, that is part of the way in which the United States went to war in Iraq against Saddam Hussein. I'm sure they asked the military, can we do it? And the answer was yes. So we don't know what happened. But that is, if I may say so, a totalitarian way of looking at government. And I can't think of anything that is much more totalitarian than government collecting all material without consideration of what the real purpose is. Now, there is another way of looking at government, which is that there is no expectation that you can produce something perfectly. You do not expect, for example, to avoid all traffic accidents. And that way of government looks at the problem as not something that is to be solved 100%. It is to be done good enough. Then you have to decide what exactly is good enough for the purpose. I'm very interested in your last comment about the ring of steel around the financial area in London. It seems to me that that's what they've done. Good enough. The 3% is pathetically small in a way, but it's so hard and it seems to be good enough. But I think that it's a matter of risk analysis. If you're trying to decide what is good enough, you have to have good risk analysis as to what is going to happen when it doesn't work. We take enormous risks as a society, witness the circumstances that led to the economic recession, which we're still trying to get out of. We allowed a number of financial organizations to take risks that ruined a lot of people, and certainly did a lot of ill to almost everyone. This was a bad analysis of risk, but it was something the government could have done a lot more to control. So I'm simply saying that we get back to what you said about culture. I think it does very much depend on the way a society regards the responsibilities of its government. If the society regards government as being responsible for protecting them totally, then you get to totalitarianism. If society regards government as doing the best job that it reasonably can in the light of this, then you get to good enough. So it comes back to what citizens demand of their government.
Yeah, good comment. There was also someone at the back, David. I think I'm in sympathy with the kinds of comments that you're making. I would comment about risk. That yes, I think risk analysis is important, but in a sense, part of the problem is also with risk analysis and risk management in particular. And I think the basic idea of risk analysis and risk management is something that any government worth its salt has to consider. However, I think there was a real issue in the shift of a logic of risk from environmental kinds of risk analysis through to the sort of risks that are associated with terrorism or whatever. And that is this, that if we're talking about climate change or something like that, then the idea of risk analysis involves saying at some point, say the climate change risk analysis people, at some point you have to say, even though we don't have full evidence yet, we have enough to know that we're going to have to change some things pretty radically if we're going to at least start to address the kinds of deterioration that have already occurred. So that's the way the argument goes. We don't have all the data in yet. We can't say conclusively that this is the case. However, the chances that they are very strong, and therefore we need to do something now. Transfer that to the area of surveillance. And then you say, well, we don't have all the evidence yet that this person really is a terrorist, but we've got to act now anyway. It's a very different kind of argument. And I think there are ways in which, if you look at that shift within risk analysis and risk management from the kind of environmental field to what you might call the human social or surveillance field, that there are difficulties around there. So I think the risk analysis mode itself has to be questioned in terms of what is appropriate in which area. But yeah, I mean, I agree that, well, I've said it already, the big questions confront us now. And I think, you know, one of them is that the sort of world that Snowden has helped us see a lot more clearly is one in which mutual suspicion is encouraged. And just on a basic level, how can you ever build a society? How can you ever build solidarity on the basis of suspicion? And I think there are many ways in which we can see that suspicion being generated. I mean, the fear question, for example. The fear question that is so important, apparently, in relation to this Muslim and Arab category, is something that you also see replicated in stranger danger taught by parents to kids. And it's another argument that has been blown out of all proportion. And so it seems to me that there is another world to work on, which is a world of mutual trust. And how do you foster that at every level, from, you know, the HASTS department at MIT through to the preschool through to whatever. So I think Snowden raises some very basic and fundamental questions for us, and to see the growth of mutual suspicion as a key dimension of what contemporary surveillance trends are revealing is to have a red light flashing and to say, well, isn't this a warning? Don't we need to ask questions about fostering the opposite? Anyway, may sound naive, but I think we're on the same page. Now, where was the other? Oh, okay.
I have a question. So I interview teenagers. I'm here on the other side, but I interview teenagers who show a startling lack of interest in the questions you think they should be thinking about. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this kind of rapid amnesia problem, since I grew up in a world where I was reassured that nobody would know what books I took out of the library as a central reassuring tenet of the society I grew in. That was supposed to be like what made America great, was that nobody would ever know what books I took out of the library, therefore I had this kind of major space in which I was allowed to think in a very particular way because I grew up in this country, versus, you know, just by the fact of using my phone, I don't know which applications will automatically share what I'm looking at and listening to. And I'm startled sometimes that I'll buy something and will be asked, do you want to share that you bought these towels with your friends on Facebook? And to realize that I have to sort of, you know, say no, or else everybody will know what towels I'm buying. So, and then a lot of people don't know to disable that, or automatically enable that. And so I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts, since this is kind of your, you know, the focus of your work, on how quickly our sensitivity has moved on this issue. You know, yes, it's fine. Yes, we came divided. Yes, it's part of our digital world, but it does seem to be a radical and quite stunning shift. And then secondly, just a second question, where do you see the spaces, since you do go around the country and talk about this, where do you see the best spaces, candidate spaces, for having these conversations?
Great questions. Okay, and of course, it's not just your library books and what the librarian knows. I mean, what about the blended learning and MOOCs and all the new online learning systems? I mean, once upon a time, students could hide how long it was that they had spent on the reading, but if the professor knows that they only got access to the document that was supposed to be read in class 2 minutes before the class began, which they do in any of those MOOCs. I mean, we use Moodle at Queen's. I don't know what online learning systems that you use, but the surveillance capacities of Moodle is tremendous. Of course, there's one interesting thing about Moodle. Students can also find out about some things about professors by just using the system in reverse. But yeah, and I agree with you totally that the change is rapid. I also think that in some ways it's accelerating. And that kind of velocity and accelerating velocity that we see in other areas is also seen in this. However, I'm not sure that I agree with your opening statement that your teenagers are, whatever you said, singularly uninterested in this question. They may not be interested in the form that I put it. You know, I'm a mere academic, but the work that I've seen done by a number of people has shown that there are some very sophisticated views of what are the boundaries of in personal practices, using social media, for example. So there's a lot of sophistication, actually, in determining what should be shared and what should be retained.
You don't know how to deal with this larger question.
Yeah. Yeah, but do we? I mean, do we know how to navigate either? I mean, I'm suggesting that maybe we need to try to think of some vocabulary that would help us think about common ideas and ideals that might help us. Well, having identified notions like suspicion, for example, as ones that seem apparently to be increasingly characterizing our social space, what kinds of alternatives and what kinds of mobilizing activities to work against that and to build something different are possible. So I think that we're in the same boat as your as the young people that you are with whom you're doing research. I think there are various kinds of venues. One of my colleagues in Ottawa works for a group called Media Smarts, and this is to stay with the same generation, so it's for teenagers. And Media Smarts does some really interesting work on encouraging mutual activity between teenagers and their teachers, their parents, and so on and so forth, that enables a bit of cross-generational discussion. So typically, I suspect one reason why the teenagers you're describing don't get the bigger question that we might think, you know, from the library book story is significant, is because we haven't had an opportunity to share those stories and to talk together about the issues. And it seems to me that, apart from anything else, we live in an increasingly ahistorical kind of culture, and therefore we don't have enough stories that connect generations around the kinds of issues that I've been talking about today. So I think that those kinds of contexts, those kinds of venues are good ones. And as I say, Media Smarts in Canada is supported by various kinds of organizations. I think it also has some government funding, but it's very sensitively done, and it encourages not some kind of rule-bound approach that suggests that here are some ways that you can do it, folks, but it encourages sitting down together in front of the screen. And my friend, who's a researcher working with and for Media Smarts, is herself mother of several teenagers, and her own stories and her own example of sitting down with her kids and discussing how to navigate being online and how to navigate signing up for social media and so on and so forth is a wonderful example, because I've also come across a fair amount of evidence that kids are kind of on their own and working out their own way through this very difficult set of contexts. But yeah, good question. But like I said, I think we're all in the same boat.
We'll take one last question before we thank Professor Lyon for working overtime, and we'll thank him, but the reception is just outside the store. So last question, and then we'll have a reception outside.
I'll keep it brief. It didn't occur to me that Facebook was a technology of betrayal until I gave it up for Lent, and realized that a lot could happen on there about me in 6 weeks, that I wasn't, you know, that sort of mutual suspicion. I was opting out of one half of that. My question has to do with a recognition that there are maybe two kinds of technology operating here, the material technologies that allow surveillance to take place and what we might call conceptual technologies within the law. And those have always evolved together, so Warren and Brandeis developed this idea of the right to privacy around the time of the penny presses and the camera.
Yeah.
And the question that I have has to do with maybe pushing back a little on mutual suspicion, because it seems to me we have colleagues that work on FOIA, which you could call a kind of conceptual technology within the law based in mutual suspicion that stands in the opposite relation to the Fourth Amendment, having to do with individuals, sure, and this being about shedding light on government activities. So I wanted to just introduce the framing as maybe a productive one and get your thoughts on what you think about maybe FOIA in particular. The Federal Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah.
And we have a colleague who's struggles with getting, and has had great success, but against exactly the kind of apparatus that you're talking about.
Yeah. Great question. Wonderful to hear that somebody's giving up something for Lent, too. This is interesting. I heard on Sunday that the Twitterverse was completely exploding after Ash Wednesday with people explaining what sorts of chocolate they were giving up for Lent. Apparently there was I'm not a personal participant, but I have good friends, namely my son, who was explaining to me about the Lent explosion over no chocolate. Anyway, this is very interesting. I mean, the freedom of information business, somebody was asking me earlier about what sorts of research that we do in the Surveillance Studies Center and within the team that I work, and it goes right across the board, from historical and archival through to freedom of information requests, through to survey work sometimes, through to dense ethnographies, through to snowball interviewing of particular kinds of groups. So we go across the whole range of possibilities for research approaches. But I must say that in our day, freedom of information requests has become a much more prevalent approach to trying to understand, and complex triangulation, because so much comes back redacted that you have to work out from several angles and with different kinds of questions what's going on. So yeah, I have some postdocs and PhD students of whom I'm very proud, because they manage wonderful FOIA kinds of requests and discover a lot of extremely a lot of material that gives us pause when we realize just how far things have gone. So yeah, I think that's a crucially important area. Okay, the suspicion. There are lots of suspicions. I was thinking more of a kind of cultural suspicion that grows, and I talked about stranger danger and children and so on to illustrate the ways in which I think there is a suspiciousness that is fostered by a certain approach that I think has to do with a governmental over-reliance, well, and governmental in the broad sense, in a Foucauldian kind of sense, through corporations as well as government administration and policing and so on. I think there is a generalized growth of suspicion that you could follow. I also think that there are theoretical ways in which suspicion can be fostered. And I must say that over the years working in surveillance studies, I've become increasingly dubious and skeptical about some kinds of theoretical suspicion. The kind of hermeneutic of suspicion that comes, I suppose, primarily from someone like Nietzsche. You see it a lot in Foucault's work, but I don't think he goes as far as Nietzsche. And I think that that leads you to suspect every single bit of knowledge as having some negative relation to power. And I don't think that that is a necessary assumption to go with, either theoretically or in everyday life. It seems to me there's a hermeneutics of retrieval, there are hermeneutics of trust, there are other kinds of hermeneutics that I think operate alongside. I think that the hermeneutic of suspicion in relation to freedom of information requests is a response precisely to an already existing breakdown of trust between citizens and governments. And so what you're doing in that case is pursuing an appropriate suspicion, not a generalized suspicion, because it's very specific. If it's a freedom of information request, you're asking some very specific kinds of questions. So I think it's a bigger question than what you're asking, but I think it's a really good question for us to pursue as well. So thanks.
Very simple.